Okay. How are you? Welcome to the Other People Podcast. I'm Brad Listy. Hope you're okay. I am in Los Angeles. It's good to be with you. I have on the program today Yamin Manai. He is a Tunisian-born writer who now lives in Paris, France. His new novel, The Ardent Swarm, is now available in translation in English from Amazon Crossing. It is the official March pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. TheNervousBreakdown.com is my online culture magazine and literary community. It has its own monthly book club. If you'd like to sign up for that, just go to TheNervousBreakdown.com, click on Book Club in the menu bar, and it's pretty simple. You get a book every month. I interview that author on this program, and it makes for an enriching cultural experience. So before we get to the interview, I want to make a brief announcement that's fairly exciting. The Other People Podcast now has its own YouTube channel, long overdue, but finally done, and done well, with some help from my social media director, Joseph Grantham. So I just want to let you know that the entire archive of this podcast, nearly 700 episodes and counting, is now available via YouTube. So if you're a YouTube person, just go to the Other People with Brad Listy podcast channel, and you can find every episode. It's all organized beautifully with like playlists. Like I did, the episodes are organized chronologically by year. So if you need to find a specific episode, you just go to the playlist section and you can track it down year by year, you know, whenever it happened to air. And I would ask too, if you don't mind, even if you're not like a big YouTuber, can you just subscribe to the channel? It does help, and it's free. You just click a button. You just press subscribe. I believe the kids on YouTube say you smash the YouTube subscribe button. So if you could do that, it would help me. I would appreciate it. And, now this podcast is on YouTube. I am now a YouTube star. So The Ardent Swarm, the new novel by Yamin Manai, is the winner of some major awards over in France, I believe. It won the Prix Comar d'Or, and it won the Prix de Cinq Continents, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It was translated from the French by Laura Vernaud. And this is a book that features bees. You can see them on the cover of the novel, on the jacket. And they play a central role in the narrative. I love when works of fiction do this in particular. I love it when movies do it. I love it when novels and short stories do it. When the natural environment is melded into the narrative in a serious way. And moreover, when I learn something about like animals or plants as an outgrowth of the story itself. That is certainly the case with The Ardent Swarm. It gave me, among other things, a much deeper appreciation for bees and the intelligence of bees and the necessity of bees. Not that I didn't know it, but it was a good reminder. So it's just fascinating. And you're going to hear Yamin Manai and I talk about that right now. I should mention, I just want to give it a brief acknowledgement that Yamin Manai speaks like four or five languages, and he himself told me that English is, I want to say it's his fourth language. So, perfectly understandable conversation, but, you know, bear with him a little bit. He's, the guy speaks like five languages. And I loved his book, loved meeting him, and I'm happy to share the conversation with you now. So here he is, folks. This is Yamin Manai, and his new novel, One More Time, the official March pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club, is called The Ardent Swarm.
I know the landscape in Tunisia. I know it very well because I had family there. The hinterland, I know the hinterland in Tunisia. I have families there, and some of my family members were doing beekeepings, but it was in my souvenirs of a child. And when I decided to write this book, I visit some beekeepers. I watched a lot of documentaries on beekeeping, and I made a lot of documentation to be relevant in what I am writing. And this is something I like when you write books, because when you write a book, you can learn also. It's an adventure from where you can learn things, and I like it. Yeah, I like when what you write can help you to be more to have more science, I would say.
So you did a lot of like book research and you watched documentaries, as you said, but did you do any experiential research where you actually went out and like wore a beekeeping outfit and actually dealt with bees?
I was very, very close to hives, and let me tell you, I wanted to be in the skin of my character, and I was without the I was without the combination of the beekeeper, and I was the bees attacked me, and I was stinged like 15 or 16 time, you know, by the bees.
Wait. So you went to a hive. And
yes.
You got stung 15 or 16 times because you didn't have the right outfit, or was it because of your attitude, or, you know, because bees, it seems like certain people don't get stung because they're just calm or they behave a certain way. Is that right?
Yeah. If you are calm, you know, the bees don't attack you. But unfortunately, something just dropped from my hand, and fall on the hive, and then the bees thought that I was attacking them, so they attacked me back, and they attacked me in it was a huge attack. And it was not 16 or it was 60 or 50, you know, 50 or 60 or 60 stings I had on my body, you know. But it was totally my fault. I still love bees, and I still like this activity of beekeeping. But I learned that you have to be precautious when you approach the bees.
Yeah, when I was a kid, my friends and I were messing around with a hive, like we were like just morons, just being foolish, and we agitated a hive, and I remember getting swarmed by bees and getting stung multiple times, and I've always been a little uncomfortable around bees since then. But reading your book, I was like, it made me aware of how amazing bees are. You know, it's one of those things that can be easy to overlook in your day-to-day existence if you're not paying careful attention, or if you don't understand like how bees and their hives and their communities operate. But it's an extraordinarily sophisticated insect world. You know, like it's a really kind of magical. I don't know. That's the feeling I got when I was reading about it. Like, these creatures. They operate in communities and hierarchies, and they make honey. Like, it's it's bananas.
Yeah. There is a lot of reasons to fall in love with bees. Their behavior is really interesting. Their job is make the other species survive, because 18% of what we eat is pollinized by bees, and when I say what we eat, I mean all the living on Earth, not only humans. All the species all the species take benefits from the work of the bees, and the way that they do it is a touch. They touch perfection, you know. Their job is very important, and they are structured, and they know what to do to make the earth viable for us. So besides, they are friendly, and when they stink, they die. So it shows you that the aim of their living is not to stink, it's not to harm, but really is to make the earth a beautiful place for us.
So how long have you been into bees since you were younger, or was it just related to this project?
I was I wanted to write a book about the fragility of the democratic experience that Tunisia was living after the Arab Spring, but I didn't want to write only about men. I always thought that man is not the main subject, but man among nature is the main subject. So I didn't find the axis that will allow me to write about this democratic experience in Tunisia and nature also. For months I was blocked because I didn't find the X, and I was on my couch one night. I was looking to a National Geographic channel, and then I saw a documentary about the bees and how they behave when they were attacked by giant hornets, and how they can defend themselves against those attacks. And then it was a kind of revelation for me. Instantly I was inspired to write this book, because I found the allegory that will permit me at the same time to speak about man and to speak about nature, and to tell that the most important is not the war between us, between the right wing, the left wing, the progressist against the nationalist, and all those things, but our main concern should be our home, our the bees, the nature around us, and those things are really in danger, and we are struggling for things without real meaning while our home is burning. And this is why I used the bees to the project.
And it was a National Geographic documentary that gave
you, yes, absolutely,
gave you your epiphany.
So if you go, for example, on YouTube, and if you write honeybees versus giant hornet, you will find some expert from this documentary that show you how bees behave, and I described this behavior in my books while looking to this documentary. Yeah. It was a kind of reference for me.
Okay, yeah. So in the Ardent Swarm, you're telling the story of a beekeeper in the hinterlands, as you put it, of Tunisia, and he absolutely loves bees. He's a charming protagonist because he's kind of like the strong, silent type, and he's really good at what he does. But what happens, in a nutshell, is that the hives that he takes care of come under attack, as you said, from, I believe they're called Asian hornets. Is that what it is? It's like it's a species of hornet.
Yes, it's a species of hornet. I think that in the United States you call them murder hornet.
Murder hornet, and, okay.
Yes, and they are in the United States since, I think, the 1 year or something like that. It's a species which is normally grow in Asia, but with the human activity, this species traveled, and it invaded the south of France. It invaded a lot of places where it should not be there, and it was also seen in the United States like 6 months ago or more.
Yeah.
You have it in United States. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to say it was up in like Washington State is what I seem to remember.
Yes.
I could be wrong, but
exactly.
I love that we call them murder hornets. It's very subtle, you know. And
yeah, and they are able to kill men also, not only bees. In the world, it's they kill like per year they kill 40 or 50 person per year are killed by attack of murder hornets.
Okay, so for people who don't have a frame of reference, like, you know, you have your honeybees, which are tiny, you know, they're about the size mm-hmm. of they're about the size of a peanut or whatever, and then a murder hornet, like a full grown murder hornet, can be quite big, actually.
Yeah, it's you take a large hand, and it's like a finger in a large hand. So,
and these hornets, as you said, if these hornets are to swarm a human being, they can kill a human being.
Those hornets absolutely can kill human beings. If you have some heart problems, or if you are old and you cannot run for your life, absolutely they can attack you. They can cover you, and they can sting you till death because they have venom in their when they sting. And if they sting you more than 100 times, you can be sure that you will die. And contrarily to bees, they can sting you several times. Bees, if you are stung by bees, you can be sure that the bee will die after that. But those hornets are able to sting you more and more till you're gone. Mm.
And the murder hornets can also obliterate a hive of honeybees in shockingly short order. Like, it happens fast, as you describe in the novel. Like, when these hornets come into contact with honeybees and decide to mount an attack, they can shred hundreds of bees in a matter of seconds, it seems like.
Yeah. Two or... how the hornets the murder hornets behave, they sniff the honey. They go from their swarm and they are go prospecting in nature, looking for something to eat, something to feed their progenitors, their young hornets. And they find a hive of bees, they are pretty happy with it, and they tag it with their pheromone. How do you call it? Sorry.
Yeah, pheromone. I mean.
Yes. They tag it, and they come back with 10 or 20 hornets, and they attack it, and 20 hornet can kill 40,000 bees in 2 hours. A hive in a hive there is 40,000 bees, 50 maybe 60 for a big hive. 10 or 20 hornets can kill all the bees in 2 hours. They are like a machine. They are made for this. They bite, and they sting like Terminators, you know. And once all the bees are dead, they enter to inside the hive. They stole the honey. They drink it like water, and they took the larva of the bees out from their cocoon, and they kill it and make with it some balls, like protein balls for their kids. So when you look to them, they behave like barbarians, like pirates, like some terrorists that we saw in the world after the Arab Spring. It's like a Daesh of nature.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like that's the thing about learning about the bees and the hornets is that, you know, as I was alluding to earlier, it's easy to overlook these creatures and to miss how sophisticated they are. Like when you talk about like a couple of hornets like happening upon a beehive and then returning to their hornet's nest and getting their friends to come with them and to coordinate a larger attack on the hive so that they can ransack it essentially and steal all the honey. This is it. It reminds me of a military operation.
Yeah, exactly. They are really organized for that, and this is how they grow in nature. This is how they evolve. This is how evolution made them behave. But the drama is a lot of bees are not prepared to defend themselves against those bees because all the beekeepers around the world, almost all the beekeepers around the world, use European honeybees. So even when you are in the United States, the bees that they are working for beekeepers are European honeybees. So when they are face to face with Asians, hornets, they didn't grow up in the same ecosystem than them, and they don't know how to defend them against those attackers. But if you are a Japanese honeybee, if you are from a race that know those attackers very well, you can defend yourself, and you can make this military attack fail.
Right. Okay. So that's kind of the, you know, without giving away too much, that's at the heart of the drama of the book is how City, your hero, you know, defends his hives against the encroachment of the murder hornets. And, mm-hmm. you know, just because it's so fascinating, I hope you don't mind explaining a little, like how the European honeybees can be adapted to defend themselves against these hornets. Like what is the process that you have to go through so that you can teach basically European honeybees what Japanese honeybees already know?
Actually, this novel was for me also the occasion of to defend an idea that I like is to say that the humanity will gain a lot with mishandling. Is this the right word?
The humanity will gain a lot
with mishandling.
I'm not sure if it's the right word. Mishandling what?
Miscegenation, is it the word? When you are from a country, from a continent, and you fall in love with another person from another continent, and you make children, for example.
Sure.
Is this miscegenation?
Yeah,
is
miscegenation.
Is this the word?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So for me, it's... This is the sense of human beings. We have to take the best from abroad, from the other places, from Earth. If you procreate, if you stay with your own community, Sorry, I will. I'm searching for my words. Your heritage, will not be renewed. I don't know if you understand me.
No, I totally understand. I think I, you know, what it's making me think of is I was watching a comedian on Netflix the other night, and he was talking about racism in particular, you know, just as one specific human problem. And the joke that he was making was that the only way that human beings are ever going to solve this is if we have sex with each other. And, you know, if we procreate and, you know, what do you want to call it? Miscegenate or cross-pollinate enough, eventually that will be the thing that snuffs it out. So his joke was like, we got to fuck our way out of this. And there's some truth to it. I mean, there's some truth to it, you know, like we when you tribalize and you stay isolated in your own little
Yes, it's the best
microculture.
way. It's the best way to create monsters. This
Right.
is true. If you, for example, procreate with someone from your family, with the cousins or something like that, you may have children that have problem. But if you do the same thing with somebody far from you, with the new patrimonia, I don't know how you say it, patrimony maybe, this allow you to renew and this make you stronger. And beekeeping is also about that. When the hive is weak, the beekeeper will introduce some queens from aboard to renew the DNA of his hive and make her stronger. So we are stronger when we allow the other people to come to us, when we welcome them, when we make community with them instead of being isolated. And we are humans. We can take the best from all the places instead of being isolated. Like bees goes from flower to another, we can also take the best from each culture, and like the beekeeper do to make his hive strongest.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think like what you're making is like a both an ecological and a political statement. And I have a lot of criticisms. There are a lot of criticisms I could make of the United States. You know, I have my problems with my country, but one thing that I think redeems it in some way and is a great strength, or it should be at least, is the fact that it's so multicultural, that there are so many different peoples here, and that, you know, historically at least, it's been somewhat open to people from all over the world. And I think that that is part of why America has had some of the success that it's had. Do you see what I'm saying? And I'm sure, you know,
Exactly, exactly.
France is the same way. I think when you get into closed societies, you know, eventually that comes back to bite you, and it's not sustainable.
Yeah, but let me tell you that we have the same problems. All we have the same problems with our countries. It's not what you are facing in the United States. It's not. It's all over the world. We are facing the same problems. We are in crisis. This coronavirus is not helping, and we are in a time of fall back. This is the word, I think.
Yeah, like
We are,
retrograde.
yes, but I think that we will. Men and women who think the same thing that than us will not keep out the fight. We'll struggle to defend our ideas, and I think that we will win because what we are struggling for makes sense, and societies are stronger, are greater. when they welcome, when they take from the others the honey that they can give them.
Yeah, you know, it's making me, as I consider your book and the story that it tells, you know, it functions as a kind of parable, and it's not a super long novel, and the world of the book is fairly contained. You know, you're dealing with this solitary beekeeper. There are a few other characters in the book with whom he interacts. But as you, like, it makes sense to me as a writer that you would be thinking of all the different themes that you wanted to play with, and you would be considering all of the, like, the political context of Tunisia in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, and trying to find a way into that material could be overwhelming. but you know, you found kind of this, like, elegant framework to explore those ideas within. Do you see what I'm saying? By making it small, it allowed you to access it.
I was kind of surprised when I read some feedbacks of American readers. They say that the novel was short and they expected to be longer. I was not able to put more pages as a scientist. I am an engineer, and I cut. You know, I just keep what makes sense. And the first version of the book was longer, but I wanted to be focused on what really was important. I didn't want to lose the reader. You know, sometimes you read a book and you feel a little bit lost. I wanted really to be focused on the story of the bees, on the story of the beekeeper, and to make the book a kind of page turner that you cannot put down, because you want to know more, because the action is tightened, you know. The framework the framework is maybe small, but it contains a lot of things. And I also wanted to give the place for the imagination of the reader and make this novel thought provoking. Because I don't want to make all the answers by myself. I didn't want to express more myself than that. I was totally drove by the character, by the main character, and I didn't want to put my prints all over the book. And this may be why the novel is maybe a little bit short, but...
Well, don't get me wrong. I love a novel is efficient.
I don't get you wrong at all. But I think that maybe in the United States you are more used with books with 400 or 500 pages. In France, this is not what we call the short novel. A short novel, it's like 100 pages in France. This is what we call a short novel. I was in the standards in France, and what the publishers do, I am quite on the standards, and I didn't had feedback from French readers saying that it's a short novel. But all the readers that I had, French or from United States or abroad, they told me that they wanted more. They wanted more of the story, and I understand, because I agree the story is beautiful, but if you want more, you can continue it in your mind, you can continue it in your soul, you can imagine what happened after. I just stopped this time of uncertainty. this time of uncertainty that Tunisia was facing, there was, and the world is facing that, the danger of this fundamentalistic Islamist, the danger that the bees are experiencing is real, and I don't have an answer for that. There is only the hope of people doing the best, their best to make things right, and this is why I ended the story that way.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when you're trying to deal with really complex political matters in a fiction, the challenge can sometimes be that, you know, you'll be writing a story, but then as the author, you'll start to let your own politics intrude into the story, which can sometimes mess things up for the reader. So I admire the way that you were able to find this story that's like very tied to the natural world. And, you know, very unique. You know, I've never read a novel about a beekeeper. But you're able to kind of explore all of this complex political stuff in this world and keep yourself out of it a bit. And I don't know if there's a way to do fiction that deals with politics that doesn't in some way find a framework like this to hang its concerns upon. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, it seemed like a lesson to me because, and I don't mean to ramble, but I feel like we're in such, as you keep saying, like we're in a global situation right now with respect to, you know, fanaticism and fundamentalism and the dangers of climate change. Like all of these issues affect pretty much everybody. And I think a lot of us who are writers can't help but respond to that stuff in our work. You know, you can't help but want to respond, but it's hard to find a way in. Otherwise you're just writing a political speech.
I agree. I was, before writing these books, I was full of hunger. I was full of judgments because the situation, I was sick with the situation. I was sick with the rise of ISIS in the Middle East. I was sick with how the Islamists take over the revolution in Tunisia. I was sick with all the terrorist attacks in Paris and on also some other places in Europe. And I was full of anger and I was full of judgment. But what literature help us to do is to cure ourselves, to be more intelligent, because you have, when you write, you have this step back towards all the facts, toward the situation, and toward the anger that habit yourself. And the literature is the world of shades of small small thoughts, it's not the place that you can make prejudice, you know. So this book really helped me to be more peaceful toward the world, and I was really happy to cure myself with literature. This is really one of magical things that writing can give you.
So, what about your personal experience of the Arab Spring? Were you in Tunisia when that happened, or were you already out of the country?
I was in Paris at the early beginning of it. I was out with some Tunisian living in Paris, because you know there is a community of Tunisian living in Paris. We are an old colony of France, so we travel a lot between the two countries, and there is a community living there. And when the revolution started in Tunisia, we make it we try to express to be the voice of the Tunisian living there in Europe. So we had several meetings here in Paris. I participated to those meetings, and once the troubled times was over and the revolution was finished, and we had this election, and the country was opened again, because for 2 months there were no planes landing in Tunisia. The country was totally isolated. There were trouble everywhere, strikes everywhere. So I was not able to come back in Tunisia and to be there at that time. But 2 months after the beginning of the Arab Spring, when things began to be calm, I went back in Tunisia and I stayed there for like 3 or 4 months. And I start noticing the changes of the societies, of the society, of the Tunisian society. So we gained a lot of things. We had hope toward the democracy. We had elections, free elections. We had the freedom of speech, which was very important. When Ben Ali, the former president, were there, it was a dictatorship, and we are not able to express ourselves. And all this, we win it with the revolution. But also, we had some new fringe of Islam coming from abroad. Some Islamist party raised. They were sponsorized by some monarchies of the Gulf, like I described it literally in the novel. And we were facing this for the very first time in Tunisia. I never saw so much beers, so much niqabs in Tunisia before. And there were some transformation in the Tunisian society. But
can I stop you there? You said you'd never seen so many beards. Is that what you said?
Yeah, beards. You know, the beard. Yes,
facial hair.
Yeah, exactly. Facial hair. Yeah.
Because you're saying that that there was what, like a like on the fringe, like after the revolution, there was a rise in Islamist fundamentalism.
Yeah, actually, there were some in Tunisia. There were some Islamist activists who were exiled by the former regime. They were exiled in England, and they came back when the revolution took place, and when the former president were gone, and it was the moment for them to come back, and they raise Islamist parties, and they had money because they were sponsored by the monarchy of the Gulf, who had a lot of money coming from petrol, so from oil. This was new in Tunisia. We didn't had this. Tunisia was a kind of modern country, and even if we were poor, but it was not the image that Tunisia were known. Tunisia is not Afghanistan, is not Saudi Arabia. The women are free from the very beginning of the Tunisian Republic. They had the right to vote. They had the right to work. They can dress like as they want. And we didn't have this fundamentalist Islam that that there that was the drawback of the revolution. But let me tell you that the freedom of speech and the freedom of belief is something that the revolution bring to us, and we have to fight this with the right weapons. Those guys who were exiled and who came back in Tunisia after the revolution was like very well welcomed in Tunisia because they were against the former regime. So for some people, they were like activists, like they had the right to be in Tunisia. And Tunisia, after the revolution, wanted to include everybody in the process. So it's not about fighting the Islam, the fundamentalists. In Tunisia now, it's not will not win the fight by exiling them again, but with education. And like this beekeeper in the novel is educating his hive to defend themselves against the giant hornets, the murder hornets, we have to educate ourselves, and we have to know our enemy, and we have to develop a speech that show the whole society that they are enable to give us solutions to our economics problem, to our will to live all together peacefully. They will make us go back and lose our modernity, lose our faith in the future. So it's a drawback of the revolution. It's something that came with the revolution, like this giant hornets came. But we have to find the right tools to deal with it. I don't know if I was very clear. I'm sorry.
No. That makes a lot of sense. And I'm wondering if when you made your trip back to Tunisia after the revolution, if that was when you first started thinking about the novel that became The Ardent Swarm. Like, were you beginning to think about wanting to write about this stuff as you were there and visiting after the revolution?
I was very surprised by this new vision of Tunisia. I didn't think that this kind of Islam will have a nest in Tunisia, but I was not really concerned. I would say I thought that the country was young, and the young people will raise and will try to jump over all this middle age mentality that those people were bringing, but I started being sick when the first terrorist attacks happened in Tunisia, and it was like three years after the revolution. 3 years after the revolution, we started to doubt about how the process will end, and if we will go into to make it, we were going to make a new country full of freedom and dreams. 3 years after the revolution, we started to doubt about all this, and then it was the moment for me to think about how to answer the situation by literature.
And just so people listening, most of whom are in the States, can understand better the geopolitics of Tunisia and that particular region, I guess especially as it relates to the Middle Eastern monarchies, that you mentioned earlier, just so I have it clear, like after the revolution, Middle Eastern monarchy started spending money to help sponsor the fundamentalist Islamists to come back to Tunisia to try to assert some power or to gain influence in the society. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. There is some fundamentalist that they have a dream of a caliph for the Islamic world, and they want to have to have the same geopolitical situation for the Islamic world than the Middle Age. You know, at the Middle Age, the Islamic world was like united, and there were a khalifa who was just like king that rules from Iraq to Morocco.
So that's, and that was the caliphate, correct? Is that what that was called?
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people want this this thing to come back, and they are they deny the local identities for all the countries composing now the Arabic and the Muslim world. You know, I'm not against a federation of countries. Let me tell you, we should all the countries of the world should work better together. And but this dream of Khalifa don't suit me, because what they are trying to implement, it's Middle Age atmosphere with Middle Age laws, like women, they don't have the right to go out from their homes. Like if you do something, you can be beaten in the public place and even decapitated sometimes. We all saw how ISIS behave, and those guys they were they wanted to be the voice of the new caliph. So I don't know, I don't want this world of terror to be my world. And we have to fight this.
And you said that you said earlier that you kind of healed yourself through the writing of this book, or you sort of sought refuge in literature. Did you come to any conclusions about how humanity, you know, might defend itself against, like, not just humanity in Tunisia or in Europe, but all over the world might defend itself? I guess you said education is the key, but you know, it seems to me sometimes when I think about it so overwhelmingly complex. You know, how are we ever going to sort this out as a species and get ourselves situated and organized into a better, like, society, and a better global society, and just a saner world?
I really don't think that if we can make it, really. I have doubt on it. I'm optimistic because I think that a lot of people are trying to light candles. And Confucius said it's better to light a candle curse the darkness. So I'm optimistic, but I recommend you read a book by Romain Gary. Romain Gary is a famous French writer, and he wrote a book about a guy who hunt the hunters of elephants in Africa. I am clear?
Yeah.
And this guy believe the hunter of the hunters in Africa believe that we are not able to be better than we are, and he think that we need a new species, a new evolution, because you know we are the fruit of this evolution right now, and maybe we are going to evaluate years and years passing. Maybe we are going to be better than we are today. And he believed that the humanity may have at one time of their evolution an organ of compassion. That's what we lack today. Compassion is an idea. And maybe if we evaluate, maybe in a few hundred years and thousand years, compassion will be an organ, and it will allow us to really feel what the other feels, and our heart will be full of compassion toward the others and toward the other species too. So maybe we are not good enough as a species right now. But if we do have time, if we don't mess up with our planet, if we don't destroy it completely, maybe we are going to evolve and to be better men. And maybe in the future, maybe in 1,000 years or 2,000 years, our sons will look at us like we look to the prehistorical man.
Right. I think there's if humanity survives and finds a way to flourish, you know, 1,000 years from now, I can't help but think that they're going to look back on this period of history and consider us to be primitive.
Yeah, I do believe that time is our ally, and we are destined to be better. Maybe we are not in our best form today. Maybe this organ of compassion will be a reality in a few years. You know, at the very beginning of the humanity, we were unable to speak. Evolution allowed us to speak and to express ourselves and to have less fights, because we were able to express what we have in our hearts. So I believe that this is the path. Maybe we are on the right path. We have just to be careful and to give us a chance to evaluate in the right way, and to have more tools to understand each other, like we gained the language several years ago. Maybe we will gain a new thing that will allow us to understand more the others. And we just need time for this, and we just need to keep our planet clean for this and viable for this.
So you've lived in Paris for what, half your life? You've been there for a long time.
Exactly, half of my life.
And do you plan to stay there, or do you think, could you ever see yourself going back to Tunisia?
I really want to go back in Tunisia. I don't know when, but I don't consider myself as settled really in Paris. Paris for me is like a trampoline that allows me to go all over the world. I am here physically, but my mind is covering all the globe. I think about all this thing, and maybe when I will be once I I'll go I'll be older. Maybe I'll go back. I wanted to be buried there with my family, but for the moment I don't really think about going back into Tunisia. I think this spot is good for me, because it gives me the necessary distance toward this country, and help me to analyze his situation. And if you were there, maybe you will lose this step back, and you will be more in the facts and the actuality. I think I was unable to write such a book if I was really there, physically there, because people are really facing problems, daily problems, and daily threats, and they don't have the time to really produce art. You know, if you want to produce art, you have to. The more the society is peaceful, the more the society is wealthy, the more the art will prosper. So Tunisia is now time for politics, for struggle, for activism, and I'm more a literature man.
How has the book been received? You know, you talked a bit about the reception, because this is the first time that you've been translated into English. What has the reception, you know, been like in Tunisia among family members or friends that you might have back there? And then, you know, obviously in France, we spoke earlier about how it has won a couple of awards or multiple awards. So the reception there has been good. But can you just talk about the reception in these various places?
In Tunisia, it was really well welcomed. I had the opportunity to visit schools, to visit students that they were working on the book, several bachelors, and at the university, people make their studies on the book. The guys who studies literature are interested in the book, and they work on it. And some of people were really happy to read it, because they felt understood. They felt understood. They felt that their struggle was well written and well presented to the world. Because when you write in French, in France, you have the possibility to present this work to the Francophone world, and the Francophone world is like more than 70 countries all around the world. There is a lot of people reading French. So. Reading in French. So when you write in French, you can be the voice of those people in a large part of the globe. In France, it was, I would say, it belongs to a kind of hidden literature, because in France, we like people writing about France, about the problem of France, and we are less open-minded than what we could expect. So it was visible by some librarians, by some literature activists who presented the book. But I didn't sell in France. It was very, very well welcomed in France, but it was not a bestseller, you know, because my publisher is Tunisian. And if you try to sell a Tunisian book in France, even if it's written in French, it's a challenge. It's a challenge because the doors are not opened. It's still a foreigner object. And if you want to sell a foreigner product, you have to access to the distributions network. And if you are an African publisher, you don't access very easily to this distribution network. But still, people loved it. A lot of librarians presented to their readers. I visited also schools in France. But since it was translated, I was really surprised to see the feedbacks and all the activity that this book is still bringing. In some websites like Amazon or Goodreads, there are over than 100 feedback, 1,000 feedback about the book. So it's really encouraging, and I am very happy about this English translation adventure that we are having right now.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to think about the book and how it's resonating cross-culturally. And, you know, I think of it in an American context. You know, I think a lot of American citizens might, you know, just a few years ago have liked to imagine that America was somehow immune to some of the extremism that, you know, was, you know, like flowering in different parts of the world. But the truth is, like, as you've been, you know, as you've been saying, these issues exist everywhere. You know, I think we're seeing a lot of the same dynamics that might have presented themselves in the Middle East and the Arab Spring in different parts of the world. You know, a lot of the same tensions. They might wear, you know, they might have different names, or they might have slight differences, but the basic dynamics are similar cross-culturally. So the story that you're telling is one that, you know, has global resonance. You know, it's well-timed.
I do believe so. I do believe so. And this choice of the beast was, for me, really, I was blessed with it, because the bees are everywhere. The honey, everybody appreciate the honey, and we cannot imagine a world without bees, without honey. The murder hornets are now a global problem. The fragility of democracy is really a problem everywhere, in America, in Russia, in France, in Africa, everywhere. The democratic process is in danger. So I think that a lot of people, when they read about this beekeeper, they have a lot of affection for him, because they he represent. It was a guide for me. Really, I just followed him to write the story. It was he guided me all over the book, all over the novel. And I think that to a lot of people, they help them to feel better, and they give them some comfort and relief.
Well, I know it's getting late in France, so I don't want to keep you too long, but I'm wondering if you're working on another book.
I do. I just finished another book. It's even shorter than this one. I don't count pages. It's not the I don't target any number of pages when I write. I just want to be the book punchy enough to make the reader don't want to put it down. And it's still about Tunisia, but it's still a universal story. It's about a teenager, and for the first time, I will use the I. I will speak. I will be directly the voice of my character. So it would be at the first. It's for the very first time I write this way, and it's about how much love a teenager can have for his dog. and how difficult to raise a dog in some countries.
All right, sold. I like that. I'm a dog lover, so that sounds like it's right up my alley.
Yeah, I think it will. Every book I wrote was for me a bless, really a bless, and this one is also, I think, will be at the same level, I hope, than The Ardent Swarm. I do believe that it's a very good story, and I hope that it will help me again to criticize the situation in Tunisia, to make my part of the job, because as a novelist, as an artist, we have to maintain this activity. We have to present novels to the Tunisian readers, and then maybe I will be blessed with a translation like for The Ardent Swarm. But it's important to maintain an artistic activity in this country and to make people read, because we lost the taste of reading in Tunisia after over than 20 years of the dictatorship and of mis the politic that that neglect the libraries and the books in general. And my first aim is to make the Tunisian read, and I hope that this novel I just finished will allow me to continue this purpose. And if I am translated again, it will be a great joy to be to share this.
Well, I'm so glad that we got a chance to spotlight The Ardent Swarm in the book club, and I'm grateful that you made the time to talk with me despite this time difference. Congratulations on the success of the book and on its translation, and congrats on finishing the new one. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much for your invitation, Brad. I'm sorry, my English may sometimes be not as I want, but I will improve myself, and maybe for the next book, if I have the chance to be translated, my English will be better. Thank you very much for this opportunity and for what you are doing for this cross culture and for literature in general.
All right, you guys, that is Yamen Manai. His new novel is called The Ardent Swarm, available in translation now from Amazon Crossing. Translated from the French by Lara Vernaud. The Ardent Swarm, the official March pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club by Yamen Manai. The Nervous Breakdown Book Club, if you're interested in joining, more on that at thenervousbreakdown.com. Sign up. The Other People Podcast is now on YouTube. Go subscribe. The Other People Podcast is offered freely. It's a listener-supported show. All episodes, almost 700, are all offered to you for free. If you listen regularly and you get something from the show and you have the means, support the show over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. For as little as a dollar a month, you can support the show. Just throw a buck in the hat every month. Or if if you're rich, you can throw $5,000 into the hat. It's up to you. But there are various tiers. It's user-friendly. There are good options. You can get a sticker. You can get an Other People t-shirt, Other People mug, Other People tote bag. All sorts of things. You can get a handwritten postcard from me, happy birthday wishes from me on an annual basis, a TNB Book Club membership. The list goes on. So check it out over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. This program has its own official app, the Other People with Brad Listy app. It, too, is free. Go get the app if you want the app. It's a great way to listen. It's a great app. It's user-friendly. It's all right there. Next week on the program, Todd Goldberg is my guest, making his return. He's got an excellent new story collection out from, I believe it's Counterpoint. It's called The Low Desert, and it's just superb. I've been pushing it on people. You got to read this book. So Todd Goldberg, always great in conversation, an old friend, and we're going to be talking next week. If you need to reach me for any reason with feedback on the show, you can write to me at letters@otherppl.com. Let me know what you think, okay? All right, bye.